Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin, and I got a friend who grew up here in Chapel Hill, Chad Luddington. He lives in Carrboro, teaches at North Carolina State, and based on what he's been telling me about from time to time at dinner, he knows more about wines than most of us, and he knows more than anybody about how wines can separate us and sometimes bring us together or mark the boundaries that separate us. Some of that wisdom he's put into his new book, The Politics of Wine in Britain, A New Cultural History. And Chad, you've agreed to come and try to educate me a little bit more on the politics of wine. How in the world did this idea get started?
So, well, first of all, D.G., thank you so much for having me here. It's a pleasure to speak about the book with someone such as yourself. What brought me to all this is your question. Well, it started off, as many academic books do, as a dissertation, as a PhD in history. And I was both working in a wine store in New York City at Columbia University, where I was studying, and was encouraged by my professors to try to combine my interest in British history with my interest in wine. And it didn't seem like a very promising idea at first, but as I looked into the possibilities, came upon what I thought was a fascinating debate, which seems to have, which was one could find here and there in various references and in books about British history, that there was a debate between port and claret lovers or drinkers of both.
And there were fans of port and fans of claret in Britain. That was a fact that there were not an astounding thing. People knew that already.
There were fans of both of these wines.
Now tell us what those wines are for those of us who don't know nothing.
So
what's
yes.
a claret?
Yeah, and I also want to point out. Well, port most people probably know about. Claret is not a fancy term in Britain and Ireland. It's just a generic term meaning red wine from Bordeaux.
Okay.
So
it's
important to know that when I say claret, and I use that term rather than red wine from Bordeaux each time.
So some people in Britain really were connected to claret or Bordeaux, red Bordeaux, and
yeah.
others to port. Now, you say everybody knows what port is. Not everybody. What's port?
And the division was based on their, usually, or at least thought to be, based on their political party. So that's what allowed me to say this debate isn't simply about, I prefer this wine, I prefer that wine. It's, if I am a Whig, a member of the Whig party, I prefer port wine. And if I'm a Tory, that is a member of the Tory party, I prefer French wine, specifically claret from Bordeaux. And so it wasn't just a debate about aesthetics, although that was part of it, but it was also a debate about politics. And this has to do with foreign policy, and in particular, who is going to get the money that England has to spend on wine, that is, we have to get our wine from somewhere.
Because we can't make wine in England.
Because no. Well, you can, but it's
not any good.
It's not very good.
Not plentiful.
And so we can't make wine in England. And wine is something that we have to have because of, or at least those who are in the middle ranks and the elite, wine is something that they had to have to prove their, or to manifest their political legitimacy, both their wealth, their status. So there's no question of doing without wine. If you were anybody with any pretensions to put a political power or a voice of some sort, you wanted to have wine. You needed to have wine.
So it's sort of like in the United States today, if you are moving into the upper classes, you're going to serve some kind of wine at your meal rather than beer or iced tea or something.
Probably,
like
that. Yes. Some, we have some of that same some of the same symbolism, and perhaps mm-hmm. even comes from Britain in that sense. But wine, in the British case, and again, I'm speaking here. I start off in the book talking about England and Scotland as distinct because they were, of course, in 1649 when the book starts, and then in 1707 they come together to form the Kingdom of Great Britain. Although it then took some while after that even to form a more united polity. But getting back to your question about port and claret, Whigs promoted, or everybody prior to, say, 1670 in Britain, their preferred tavern wine was claret. But as the French and the English at this point began to engage in economic warfare, the French began it by putting a high tariff on English cloth in order to protect their own nascent cloth industry. Well, the English respond at this point by saying, well, if you're going to tax our number one export to you, we're going to tax your number one export to us, and that is red wine. And specifically, the wine that was most often consumed in England was claret. that is red wine from Bordeaux. So, as these tariff wars continue, that meant the price of Bordeaux shoots up in England, the traditional market for Bordeaux producers. Well, consequently, merchants began to say, we need wine from somewhere for those who can't afford this, the new price on a French wine. So off they go to Portugal prospecting for a different type of wine. Initially then, port was meant to be a replacement for claret. That is, it's simply a substitute at the lower economic era before for the middling sorts to drink wine from Portugal. Now, Whigs thought this was good foreign policy. That's the whole point, because they didn't want to spend precious English coin on wine in France and give away their money to French producers at the time. They would much rather have given their money to Portuguese producers, because Portugal was a reliable ally both against France and also against Spain. And so that port wine was caught up in Whig foreign policy. Tories, meanwhile, who didn't necessarily love France, nevertheless admired the strength of the French monarchy, they admired the strength of the church in France, and they believed that the king should be more powerful than Parliament, because Parliament ultimately, if it had too much power, would lead to something like democracy and anarchy. So consequently, they didn't mind spending money on French wine.
So this is during the 1600s, which is the time of revolution in Britain, where people are either beheading their king or kicking him out. Or?
Yeah, this is very much the time of revolution. The book actually starts in 1649 with the beheading of Charles I, who in January 1649, again, lost his head, and the Commonwealth, which would later come under Cromwell, came into play. And then in 1660, the monarchy is restored. But then in 1688, I think you're alluding to, you have this
glorious
revolution. And during all this time, there's a transition, broadly speaking, among the political classes from seeing the Netherlands as the great enemy to France being the great enemy. And so consequently, when that transformation is made in the early 1680s, or maybe even 1670s, depending on which historian you agree with, but sometime in this period, even prior to the Glorious Revolution, at that point, wine from France also becomes suspect to those who see France as the greater enemy. So that's when you get a shift away from, at least in some circles, especially among the Whigs, thinking that French wine is not what we should be drinking.
It's unpatriotic. Unpatriotic to drink French wine, since they're our economic enemy. So we don't. That would be disloyal almost. They're our enemy. Why should we have their?
Well, according to mercantilist economic principles, you wanted to keep as much of your own coin at home as possible. And any time you were sending coin over to an enemy, that is, it was all about sort of as a theory based on, you might say, hoarding, as it were. And the more coin, the more gold and silver we have in our kingdom, the healthier our economy is going to be. So we try to construct an economy based around not having to purchase any product from abroad that we don't need, producing everything at home. Or it's also an impetus for colonies in some of our colonies. In fact, South Carolina for a while was thought of as a place that might be able to produce wine so that we could get it, or English could get it from one of their own colonies as opposed to having to go to France. So that's the reason that Whigs, at least, don't want to buy French wine. But the thing is, though, those Whigs, as they become the dominant political party in the early years of the 18th century, also have to have a wine that gives them distinction. So what's fascinating is Whig political leaders on a popular level advocate for the middle class, the middle ranks, because again, the poor were not able to afford wine of any sort. But for the middle ranks, who were the bulk of wine consumers, because their numbers were greater than the elite, the aristocracy and major landowners of other sorts, you should be drinking Portuguese wine, they said. But for themselves, interestingly, their argument was, we need a wine that reveals our distinction, that reveals our moral integrity, and we show that through the aesthetics of wine, through our taste. So you have taste on a popular level, which Whigs believe should be for Portuguese wine. On a personal level, those leading Whigs were saying, for us, Portuguese wine at this point, port, is not that fancy. It doesn't actually reveal anything about us. Whereas French wine, because of the fact that the price was now so high, some French producers, especially in Bordeaux, were making a wine that was discernibly different than other times. That it was, the quality was discernibly different from previous claret. And that meant that the consumers now, these Whig consumers, again, the elite of the Whigs, could say, this wine, as we drink it, we can discuss it and we can reveal our own aesthetic credibility, which is a way to reinforce our political legitimacy. And the reason, again, another reason the book starts when it does is because this period you call revolutions is precisely that. In particular, what it sees is a decline of a belief in the inherent legitimacy of those people who were born legitimate through aristocracy, and a rise of a different conception that people are not legitimate based on birth, but on something else. What is that thing? Well, it's very hard to create political legitimacy out of nothing, as it were, out of a new money family in this case. It's because money alone was not thought, as it might in our society, to legitimize you. So aesthetics, taste becomes a way for these new money Whigs to say, we may not have an aristocratic background, but look at our ability to talk about this wine, or to talk about this mahogany table, to talk about the new stemware we have, to talk about the paintings on the wall, to talk about the architecture in our homes. And this is what helps to legitimize them. It, in a sense, concretizes their aesthetic belief in things, or their aesthetic judgment in things, and gives them the kind of legitimacy they might not have, because as Whigs, they believed, again, that mercantile wealth should be included, whereas the Tories, the old-fashioned party, the conservative party, was still clinging to a notion that it's aristocracy, it's wealth, it's birth. Sorry, it's birth, not wealth, that legitimizes you politically.
We're visiting with Chad Ludington about his new book, The Politics of Wine in Britain, A New Cultural History. He and I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Chad Ludington is my guest. Chad grew up in Chapel Hill. He now lives in Carrboro, teaches at North Carolina State University. And I guess, Chad, this is your first book.
It is. A long time coming. I guess I can't apologize. I won't apologize for it now, but I wish it had been sooner, but here it is.
It's worth waiting for. It's The Politics of Wine in Britain. And for anybody who joined us late, we're talking about how attachments to wine might define your political views in Britain during the late 1600s, 1700s. And Whigs, Tories, all of these things. Whigs and Tories don't mean exactly the same thing that they do in our American history, but basically Tories are those who support the king and Whigs are those who say more, let's get the people or let's get us involved more in that. I loved your description before the break of Whigs who are sort of newly rich people trying to prove themselves worthy of their new power that they have. Mm-hmm. And I just kept thinking about everybody here's gone crazy about Downton Abbey. Are you watching Downton Abbey? Or you hear people talking about it? I mean, what does that represent? What part of Britain does that represent? Are these Whigs or Tories here Downton Abbey?
Most of the older characters, most of the male characters, politics have changed by the time you had the early 20th century when Downton Abbey.
Yeah, but it's still a connective link there.
But the Tory party actually as a party still existed and still represented the conservative faction. Lord Grantham would be a good example of a Tory. And in fact, the Tory party is still the name for the conservative party today. The Whigs essentially died out circa 1860 and became the Liberal Party. There was a split within the Whig Party that essentially what emerged out of that was the Liberal Party. And the Liberal Party then itself was somewhat divided by the events of the early 20th century, and you have the split there between the Liberals and off to the left of them, you might the Labor Party. So I would say in Downton Abbey, many of the women would probably lean Liberal, whereas many of the men, not all, probably lean more.
Now, your book does not cover this period.
No.
But what would there be any leftover of the wine, the attachment to wine that we could see on the with the Downton Abbey characters? Or are they all drinking some brand new kind
of
wine?
The wonderful question. In fact, part of what led me to my own study was a myth perpetuated in the 19th and early 20th century that you could tell a gentleman's politics, that is Liberal or Tory, based on what wines were consumed then. Specifically, Tories would drink claret and Whigs would drink port. at this point, port was very much respected in fine wine. So port had gone upscale, and that's part of the story that I tell. So by the time of, say, Downton Abbey, where the tenet set, there is a notion that a conservative, a Tory gentleman, you can tell his politics right away by, if given a choice, he immediately says, I'd like some claret, and probably fine claret. Whereas a liberal would say, because Labour Party, again, would have said beer, probably, but the liberal, party member circa 1910 will say, would have said port. And that was reflected back onto, or projected, excuse me, back onto the 18th century by people at the time saying, if liberals are descended from Whigs, port must be the Whig wine, and if conservatives, Tories are the same, their wine is claret. This must have been the same argument going on. But as I just said to you before the break, one of the things that's fascinating is, yes, indeed, port was Whig in the sense that it was promoted on a popular level by those Whigs. But among the Whig leaders themselves, they weren't drinking port.
Yeah, well, you keep hypocritical, aren't they? Right?
Well, certainly they were accused by their Tory opponents of being hypocritical, precisely because they were advocating for, again, not the masses, because the masses weren't drinking, certainly the working class masses, but for the middle ranks who've constituted the greatest number of consumers, they were saying, you all should be drinking port. We want you to spend your money that way. But for us, we're going to drink fine claret, because that, again, gives us this political distinction that gives us that reveals our aesthetic sensibility and credibility, which then grounds our political legitimacy in a way that we need because, as you said, we don't have the aristocratic background necessarily.
Well, now, talk to us about, forget politics for a moment, and talk to us about these two wines, claret and port. Claret being red Bordeaux wine and port being a wine that comes from Portugal,
okay,
and which maybe its quality has improved over the times. What kinds of people now, forget politics, what kinds of people now drink port and what kinds of people like red Bordeaux wines?
Now, you're saying?
Yeah, well, today. And what's the difference? From a wine expert, what's the difference between
these? Well, the difference is that port has become, it was initially intended, when my study starts, it was initially intended to be a substitute for claret. But because different grapes, different climate, different soil, different winemaking know-how, it emerged or ultimately developed into quite a different wine. In fact, it moved in the direction of being a fortified wine and a sweet wine. So today, the style that's been settled on, broadly speaking, now port comes in a variety of sub-styles, you might say, but broadly speaking, port is a fortified wine. It's always a fortified wine, and it is sweet to various degrees, emphasizing if it's wood aged, a certain flavor set, and if it's bottle aged, a different flavor set. But it's fundamentally it's sweet and it's fortified, and that has come to be seen as a proper type, at least in English speaking countries, after dinner wine. Okay. Whereas claret was, at the time when my study begins, was a generically produced wine, not necessarily mostly not very high quality, but because the tariff on it was placed across the same amount on all claret wines coming in from France into England, certain producers, in order to make the wine worth the while of their consumers in England, said, I'm going to make a discernibly higher quality wine, which will be worth the while of wealthy consumers to spend the extra tax on. Because the more money I put into the wine as I produce it, then the smaller the percentage of tax is at the final end for the consumer. So claret at that point, gradually, just as port changes over time and becomes a fortified sweet wine, again, it's a long process. Claret also changes in the sense that it goes from being what we might call sort of a typical French vin de pays, sort of country wine, often rosé in color, to being a wine that's much deeper in color, deeper in flavor, lasts much longer in terms of its time. You can keep it in your cellar. In other words, you don't have to consume it within the year. So it becomes a much more, maybe I hate to use it, but maybe a serious wine. And in fact, it becomes partly because of the amount of money invested in production, partly because of the British wealth and prestige in the 19th century, 18th and 19th centuries, claret becomes seen throughout the world as one of the, red Bordeaux, one of the fine wines of all the world. In the 19th century, port would also finally gain that status, again, because of British consumers and the power and prestige of Britain. port would also become seen as one of the world's fine wines. And I think they both are, but they're both now, in this day and age, very different. But you can also purchase them, getting back to your question about who drinks them today. There's inexpensive claret. There's, you know, the claret at £3 a bottle, what they often call grocer's claret. And there, of course, is Chateau Aubryon or Chateau Lafite, you know, which you can spend, depending on the year, thousands of dollars per bottle. Port comes in, or you can get very inexpensive port. And in fact, the Portuguese themselves mostly drink a lot of inexpensive port. The French, believe it or not, drink a lot of inexpensive port, and they drink it as an aperitif before dinner.
Before dinner.
And that's a very important market for Portuguese producers, because the French actually drain off or purchase much of their lower quality stock. But the margins are much greater for the producers, so they desperately need the French market to continue purchasing inexpensive port. The British, the Americans, and now increasingly the Chinese, Japanese, they're the biggest consumers of very high-end port, where the margins are smaller for the producers, but the product is a more satisfying one if you have the time and money. But that's, again, part of the whole difficulty is, I mean, part of the issue is always the money.
Before we take a break, just on this, getting back to the politics of wine, you've persuaded us that claret or red Bordeaux and port, these wines which were the subject of your book, are really not the same thing as they today as they were back then. They're much improved quality.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So that somebody back then who drank today's port or today's claret might not recognize it.
I think you have that right in the sense
that
they have evolved greatly, and they are very different wines. Most wine writers, wine consumers argue that we're living probably in the period that has the best quality wines in human history. Now again, that's a little bit of a Whig conception to make readers really confused about, but a Whig conception of history that things are always getting better and we're always improving in a positive direction. But I think there's some truth to that in the sense that people know more about the science of winemaking. There's less what you might call just sort of simple. Planque, as the French call it, sort of just a wine that's poorly made, that's essentially astringent juice that you use to wash down your food. Most wines are more carefully made now throughout the world, but in many ways, port and claret led the way in becoming increasing the quality of production.
Well,
and yes, that has led to wines that might not be recognized by people from the 18th century, where they'd get in a time capsule and come up to today. They might have no clue what we're talking about.
We're visiting with Chad Ludington about his book, The Politics of Wine in Britain, A New Cultural History, and he and I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking? This is D.G. Martin. I'm visiting with Chad Ludington. Chad, many of you know him, grew up in Chapel Hill, and he lives in Carrboro. He's teaching, we forgive him because he's teaching at North Carolina State now. and I don't think there's any disloyalty about it in teaching history, but right now we're talking about wine, but we are talking about history a little bit.
Oh, I think a little bit of both.
I want to ask you a question. I'm not sure whether this is about wine or history, but your book is you separate the Whigs and the Tories so strongly on the basis of red Bordeaux or claret wine and port wine that comes from it was manufactured in Portugal. But was nobody drinking white wine back then?
Good question. Now, there's a lot of evidence people were drinking white wine. Red wine was preferred, certainly by men. This gets into a question of women wine consumers, and who seem maybe from a very early point to have, or they put it in academic speak without being too confusing, white wine may have been gendered feminine at a fairly early stage. So people were drinking. Certainly women, we have evidence of them drinking more white wine than red.
And where was it coming from?
White wine would come from France, would come from Portugal. There's in fact something that's hard to get in America, but it's called white port. So there's a variety of white port. One of the most popular white wines was sherry. Now, sherry, again, some of my enophile listeners will say, Chad, sherry comes in all kinds of colors. It's not necessarily white. True enough, that it can be dark brown in color. The sweetest sherry is dark, in fact, dark brown. But sherry was considered lighter colored and often was, and it still is, mostly a sort of a straw colored or a pale colored wine. So that was usually the most popular white wine. Champagne, which only the elite could afford in Britain, was consumed. That was also generally white, although you can get red champagne, believe it or not, not just pink, but red champagne. But that was generally a light-flavored wine, too.
Did any of those wines get involved in the politics and the identification with respect to the difference between the Whigs and the Tories?
You know, they were considered politically neutral, and I think that's because they weren't consumed in large enough amounts for the politicians, economists to be concerned about the fact that maybe a large amount of English coin is going to head off to Portugal or to France for these white wines. I should point out another wine that was popular at the time, White Lisbon, as they called it. That is a white wine that came from around the city of Lisbon. There are still some vineyards around the city of Lisbon, but mostly urban growth has plowed them under. Another example of a white wine that was pretty popular. But I think just because the amounts were so small, because most consumers were male, and most male consumers preferred some form of red wine. Now, why that is, again, it could be a gender issue with all the I don't actually know, but red wine was perceived to be, I think, a more masculine drink, just as in some ways it is now. I mean, Chardonnay gets used sometimes in American society as an example of sort of effeminacy, and this isn't, so there's some connection here.
Yeah, well, speaking of connections, the time that you write about parallels the development of the British colonies the English colonies in North America. Mm-hmm. And what? How did that wine identification, red and claret with Tories and port with Whigs, how did that carry over, if at all, into America?
Yeah, you know, that's a wonderful question, and I need to do more research there in the long run. But I also, my general sense is that both of those wines were fairly rare, except in the most rarefied circles, Thomas Jefferson being one, George Washington being another, who actually knew about and had the money to purchase carefully imported wines from France and Portugal. But the most commonly consumed wine in colonial America was Madeira, which is a Portuguese wine, but as you know, DG, comes from the islands, the island of Madeira, which is off the west coast of Africa, and was a stopping point for European ships of all nations on their way to, where they would catch the trade winds. They would head south toward Northwest Africa, where they would catch
the
trade winds.
So they had some extra room in the hold of the ship. They could carry a few cartons of, or bottles? Did they come in bottles or cask?
Precisely. They would offload some goods in Madeira, but often they would then fill up with, and they wanted the weight, the ballast in the hold of the ship. So Madeira was the wine that was then transported to the Americas, usually, of course, going by way of the Caribbean, and then up the East Coast, where it would be dropped off. And in fact, one of the interesting things, well, so Madeira becomes, whether it's Charleston or Baltimore or Philadelphia or New York, it becomes the most popular wine. And in some of these cities, Savannah is another good example of a city that I believe Savannah still has, but maybe Philadelphia does too, perhaps Charleston. But Madeira drinking clubs, mostly very wealthy conservative gentlemen these days.
So it started out because it was inexpensive or less expensive than the other, and now it
precisely.
Is...
It started out because it was inexpensive, but these old families in the colonies who continue to remember that they were old families in those colonies, now, you know, for them it's by no means inexpensive, and it's a show of their ancient lineage, as it were, of their wealth, and it's a wonderful sort of historical curiosity. So they're still drinking Madeira in some cases, but yes, Madeira was the most commonly consumed wine. But there were, again, some consumers of port and claret, but mostly those wines, and this gets into the way wines are made and the fortification. Claret certainly had a greater chance of spoiling because it wasn't fortified. So importing a non-fortified wine, especially in cask during the 18th century, would have been to take a major risk that by the time the wine arrived in North America, it was acidified. That is, it had turned to
so the aging process was not good for it.
Turned to vinegar, basically.
Wow.
And so that was one of the things that was problematic at the time. So Madeira, because like port, it is a fortified wine, and because it's the only wine that is made by being abused by the sun, by oxygen, and all of these things, and yet somehow it still has wonderful liveliness, and it's a very refreshing wine in many ways. Madeira could withstand the rigors of the crossing, and in fact, the rigors of the crossing were thought to enhance its qualities. So wine Madeira that was not, for some reason, offloaded in the North American colonies, that made its way back to Britain, was increased in value because it had made the transatlantic crossing. So you get something called East India Madeira back in England, or in Scotland, that was considered the highest quality because it had actually made the voyage. And then there's other Madeiras that were put on boats going, West India Madeira, but you also get East India Madeira. That Madeira they simply put on boats to send off to India to come back just to take the voyage. Just to abuse it, as it were, because it was thought to improve in the abuse that it got in the hold of a ship.
You keep saying it was thought.
It was thought.
You don't endorse that. I think you're basically saying I don't agree with that. But is there a theory that you could defend that the quality of wine is improved in some of Madeira is improved in some cases by the torture that it goes through in various stages?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You keep saying it was thought. You don't believe, or do you believe that?
I do believe that. I do believe that.
You believe that it is better because of the torture?
Well, I think that my impression, even now in Madeira, because they don't put the Madeira on boats to send off, but the whole process of making it is meant to duplicate the rough experience of transatlantic or trans-Pacific crossing.
Wow.
So they quite literally, they cook the wine, they expose it to oxygen, they have machines that actually shake the barrels as if, or sort of sway the barrels as if they're in the hold of a ship. So in that sense, I think Madeira does improve through this harsh treatment in a way that other wines, if you tried it with them, it wouldn't work. They would end up worse for the wear.
Well, this is fascinating, and it's not really on the topic of Chad Luddington's new book, The Politics of Wine in Britain, A New Cultural History, but we'll try to get back on topic after this short break. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guest is Chad Luddington. We're talking about his new book, The Politics of Wine in Britain, A New Cultural History. Chad, we got, we're wonderfully off topic, I guess. But we're talking about wines, and we're still talking about the culture of wines, just more in a modern context. You mentioned, when we first began, you mentioned the story of the execution of King Charles I. This is sort of the beginning of your book. He was a brave guy, wasn't he? Going to his, they're going to chop his head off, and he wants to have a sip of wine before he goes.
Well, just before he had his head chopped off, I opened the book in part because it's a dramatic moment. But he goes to the Tower with nothing but claret in his stomach, that is red wine from Bordeaux in his stomach, and a little bit of bread. Of course, it was meant to sort of replicate the Eucharist,
and communion experience.
And he was heading off in his own mind as a Christ-like martyr. But the reason the symbolism is also more important than the wine at that very moment. Becomes firmly established as a symbol of royalism. That is, those who followed, who wanted Charles alive, or they wanted his son on the throne once he was dead. And so wine gets linked at that moment in a very strong way to the royalist faction, the court faction.
So this story that you tell in your book about the king wanting to have a sip of wine and a little bit of bread and nothing else in his this circulated among the royalists as a symbol.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And in fact, that's the story circulates. But that's a question among historians. How much do these things circulate? How do we know? A lot of it was oral dissemination, so we can't always prove these things. But the very fact that the evidence is there in various eyewitnesses who said, I saw Charles do this, but allowed me to actually write the story, is quite clear. So that story did circulate, but also then we know from the behavior, from diaries, from eyewitnesses, from poems, that royalists continued after the death of their king. They continued to drink to his memory in wine throughout the whole period known as the interregnum, that is between the reigns.
During the Cromwell times.
So yes, the interregnum, Cromwell's time, etc. So 1649 to May of 1660, there is no king in either England or Scotland or Ireland. And then from 1660 onward, when the monarchy is restored, then, of course, you have a king again.
Well, all kinds of things I want to ask you about. And one of these you referred to early in our conversation, and that is that Scotland and England were different countries.
Mm-hmm.
And up until 1707. And you indicated that maybe the wine drinking identification was different in the two countries. And just got a few minutes, but can you summarize that for us and explain why that was?
Sure. No, it's that they were very much different, at least at the beginning. And part of my study is using wine as a barometer to see how England and Scotland come together on some levels, culturally, politically, et cetera. But at the beginning of, in the late 1600s, that is the late 17th century in Scotland, claret was also the most popular wine. But there, at the Union in 1707, what happens is tariff rates, the English tariff rate, is applied across the new kingdom of Great Britain. So that means the Scottish now suddenly have to pay the same high price, the high tariff, on French wines. But French wine also being, by now it's been transformed in England to no longer being the most popular wine because the cost was simply too much. But the Scots had stuck to claret, and now they find that the cost has gone up. One of the ways the Scots, at least patriotic Scots, of various political stripes, then manifest their own frustration, anger at, rejection of, depending on what their political views were, the Union of 1707 was to drink illegally imported or fraudulently declared claret. That is, we're going to resist Anglicization by drinking something that was illegally brought in, that's going to tick off the customs officials in London. And moreover, it symbolizes the old alliance. It symbolizes a past when we weren't in this union. So the Scots have always been and continue to be ambivalent about the union. The union gives them a bigger stage to play on. It gives them, has brought them, much greater wealth than they would have ever had without the union. At the same time, Scotland had been an independent kingdom and had successfully resisted, for the most part, with a few exceptions, successfully resisted English attempts to forcefully unify them for centuries. And now they've joined in union, so they look for symbolic ways to resist the union that many of them actually are glad has taken, is now in place. But nevertheless, they resent the fact that it's a little bit of a devil's bargain for them.
Yeah, sort of like, Chad, like in times when I was growing up, the Southerners, they were so lucky to be a part of the United States, but they wanted to say, we really wish we'd won the war and could be a separate country. But they knew that that would have been terrible for them.
Yeah, no, I think that's probably a very good analogy. An ambivalent attitude towards the relationship to the more powerful part, in this case England, but you're right, the United States, for some.
So the Scots, like the Bostonians of 1774 or whenever they threw the tea, were resentful of the taxes that were being imposed on them, mm-hmm. without their consent, without mm-hmm. The English were making them pay.
So, in 1707 with the Union itself.
Yeah,
they
were protesting by drinking claret,
unpaid
with taxes, because they thought that was crazy. On the other hand, the tariffs themselves had to be had to become important as income producers for the income for the government. I mean, people said, we can't do away with the tariffs on claret because we got to have money to run the government.
Yeah. But I think I'm missing the specific question there, DG. What?
Well, it is just these taxes bring income. The tariff mm-hmm. on the claret is mm-hmm. an income producing, and whenever there's a tax that produces income, like our lottery, people become dependent on it, even if they don't like it.
Yeah. So that's again. Well, the taxation element, the fiscal element of wine is hugely important for England, for Scotland, for Britain as a whole. And in case of Scotland, one of the things that that William Pitt the Younger, who becomes prime minister just as the 13 colonies has successfully broken away, one of the things that he first identifies that he has to do is end this fraudulently declared or illegally imported claret business in Scotland, because there's too much wine that's coming in, too much French wine that's coming in as Portuguese wine, therefore it's a lower tariff rate. And he's looking for any and every means to pay for the war in America, as well as the debt they had incurred with the so-called Seven Years' War or what we call the French and Indian War. So it's a government concern throughout that the Scots are doing this. The English were also, believe me, up to their ears in smuggling.
Well, this is a topic that I wish we could talk about forever. And those lucky students of yours at North Carolina State who have you as a teacher are well blessed. We want to thank Chad Luddington for talking to us about wine and politics in connection with the recent new book, or the recent issuance of his first book, The Politics of Wine in Britain, A New Cultural History. Thanks, Chad.
Well, thank you, DG. It's been my pleasure.
Thanks to all of y'all for listening.